year.
Okay, let me begin by thanking the organizers for putting together such a great meeting. I also want to acknowledge the collaborators on this. This work actually started here at KITP about 5 years ago with Craig Maloney, who was a postdoc at the time and now is at Carnegie Mellon, and a student, Mike Salerno, has been involved in the continuing efforts. And some of the questions I want to address today are how the global strain in a material is accommodated by microscopic displacements, whether there is a typical size of event, and more generally, how the size of events or earthquakes, I may refer them to, are distributed in energy, location, and time. And one of the things that I'm going to show you is that inertia in the dynamics has a very large effect on the dynamics. And many systems, you find inertia drives things non-critical. In this case, you seem to only get criticality with inertia. So what I was motivated by are the fact that a wide range of systems listed here show a power law distribution of events, sometimes called avalanches or earthquakes, depending upon the context. And the thing that they share is that they display this behavior when they're driven slowly. That is, when some external parameter is changed in a slow manner. And in many of these cases, either because the objects are large or because one's interested in large length scales, one can ignore temperature, that effectively at the large length scale, the thermal activation or the thermal energy scale is very small compared to the energy scale of the events. So we're going to focus on quasi-static, meaning slow drive, not necessarily slow motion of the atoms, zero temperature, dynamics, and with inertia. So this is just a piece of the elephant that we're discussing at the meeting. We want to focus on this limit and see what we can understand. So I'm going to do simulations. Most of what I'll show you is two-dimensional. Well, I'll just show you three-dimensional results. Nothing much changes. Most of what I'm going to show you is binary Lenard-Jones mixtures. We've looked at a couple of different size ratios. We've also looked at harmonic instead of Lenard-Jones. Again, this doesn't change the results I'll show you. The typical diameter and binding energy of the Lenard-Jones will be my units. We quench at zero pressure. That protocol doesn't matter to what I'll tell you. And we work at zero temperature, and what is critically important is how we take the energy out. Because even though we're at zero temperature, we're doing work, we're putting energy into the system, we have to remove it, okay? Now, physically, we know that the equations of motion should be Galilean invariant, and so the way we take the energy out should only depend upon velocity differences, not on absolute velocities. And that turns out to be absolutely critical in terms of the results that I'll show you. But if you're careful about doing it this way, it doesn't matter too much. We're going to look in a limit where the motion is underdamped, even at small length scales, and it turns out then, in general, the long wavelength modes of systems tend to be underdamped, just the hydrodynamic modes. Normally, I have periodic boundary conditions, sometimes confined. We've looked at this kind of shear where you compress and expand at constant area. That would be pure shear. We've also looked at simple shear where you do something moving the top and bottom relative to each other. Again, you see the same results. And we want to go slowly enough that everything depends just on the total strain we've accumulated, not on the time scale. That's very different than saying all the atoms move slowly at every time, which is another thing you might mean by quasi-static. But we know that in an earthquake, for example, the motion is not slow, right? It's very underdammed, sound propagation, et cetera. So that's what I mean by quasi-static. The external drive is slow enough that the events are separated. So what we do is we start to strain the system. We see the shear stress begin to rise. And as we were discussing earlier, there's many small events that happen. And for what we can see in the limit of large size, no matter how small you are, no matter how low the shear, you start seeing plastic events. But they accumulate, and in this regime, the number and nature of events is somewhat dependent upon the protocol. But by the time you've gotten into the large strain limit, you're effectively seeing something that's independent of the past history of the sample, and that's what I'm going to focus on today. We see similar things down here, but the distributions are not so universal. So if you look in this steady state regime, you see that the stress shows these serrations that we've talked about before. Okay, we want to look at these, which produce events, as illustrated here, that can be very, very large. Now, during this rise, basically you're just pushing energy into the system with the external work, and during these drops, that energy is being dissipated. So another way of plotting this is to take the energy in the system minus the work, and then during this regime, you should just see a flat energy. Okay, so this is just saying that the work that you've done has just balanced the change in potential energy, and so on those rising parts of the stress curve, this quantity is just constant. And so we're going to quantify events by the energy drop that's associated with an event where suddenly things start to move, you get kinetic energy, and you get dissipation, and eventually you get another plateau. But we want to look at causally connected events. So for example, here there's a little plateau. And I don't want to count this as two events if once this happened, it necessarily implied that would happen. And in many cases, you find that a single event, a causal, something moving, will proceed by a whole series of spiky kinetic energy changes. And we want to lump those together because they're all causally connected. Now, using the kinetic, yeah?
Is it always clear that it's causally connected or not? I mean, it's got some sort of distribution where you do not know is it connected or not.
Well, we have a way of trying to isolate them, which I'll show you. So let me, but say here, this is an expansion of what looked like a simple peak in the previous picture. This is the this ratio of kinetic energy to dissipation, or vice versa. And you see there's a whole bunch of structure in there, okay? So how do I know that that's causally connected? So that's what I'm going to try to get to, okay? I could say, well, an event is over when the kinetic energy has dropped to some value. But that's sort of a very unsatisfactory viewpoint because this will keep decaying exponentially as long as I want to wait, okay? What we're going to look at instead is a ratio of the dissipation rate to the kinetic energy. That's shown here, and you can see that in between these events, it's constant. And basically, the reason for this is the dissipation is related to velocity differences, and therefore to derivatives of the velocity field. So you get a power, or powers, of the wave vector. And so this ratio is directly proportional to the wave vector squared, effectively. And it's telling you what the wave vector of the modes with the energy is. So what you see is initially, when things start to move, it's atoms slipping past each other, and the energy is all at very small wavelengths. And then there's a cascade where that spreads into longer and longer wavelengths in the problem. And in the first talk this morning, this whole analysis of the thermal flow, initially the energy is really some sort of coherent vibrations, and it's only after time and length that it turns into true thermal energy. So there's sort of a conversion going on from things that you would describe in terms of real kinetic motion of a few particles to things which is just heat, which is spread over a wide range of modes, eventually the long wavelength modes, which are the least damped in any system. Okay? So you're seeing a cascade of energy going from local things to global. And basically, you can take the point where the energy has gone into the long wavelength modes, and at that point, we find that the energy, the event is done. Now, we can check that this is a good definition by stopping strain during the event and just waiting to see what happens, and that doesn't affect any of the results that I've shown you. Okay? There's a threshold based on a multiple of this ratio for that given size, which turns out to be conservative and to work. But again, as I say, we've done things just completely stopping and we don't see any change. So I don't want to get too carried away on that. Maybe we can wait for the discussion. Yeah?
Sharp shock, and then the spreads out, and I think
Yes, so there are actually modes that will go across the system, and so in principle, what? Okay, they are. We eventually damp them. This they're very weakly damp, but they are eventually damp. But yeah, you. Yeah, it's more the anharmonicity that couples the different modes that leads to truly randomness, which would cause it as heat. But that cascade is a whole part of this. It's a complicated dynamics, and let's leave it at that. So what do we find when we look at these events? You can see that there was a distribution of these drops, and in fact, it's a power law. This is showing systems from 25 to 400 linear dimension, okay, so relatively large systems. Each one, the bigger the system, you have to go more slowly, and over a wide range of decades, you see a 1 over energy type of distribution. Just to show you that that really is a 1 over E, I'll multiply by E, and you can see that it's relatively flat within the experimental noise over quite a wide range. And if you look at the size of the system, you can see the size of the events, you can see that they're bigger maximum event, the bigger the system size. And if we say that the maximum event scales like some power of the system size, we can collapse the data. There's a rule on these exponents, the total amount of work, if the stress is independent of system size, the total work goes as the area of the system. And so the number of events has to scale also as a power of system size in order to make this collapse work. So there's a single exponent that determines the scaling on both the x and y axes. So we get a nice collapse with a maximum event going like some power of the system size close to one in two dimensions. Now, this power law of order one turns out to be surprisingly general. I've shown you results for two dimensions. This purple curve is that same system, okay? But here I'm comparing results for the same system size with harmonic interactions instead of Lennard-Jones, with a different thermostat, diffuse particle dynamics, as opposed to what we use. It's a small technical difference. And also, in this case, simple shear instead of pure shear. And again, we don't have quite as much data, but it's a very similar result. This shows systems that are three-dimensional but confined to be thin in one direction, not periodic boundary conditions. This was meant to model the Earth's crust, some thin layer. And again, the same thing. These are offset for clarity. And this is a fully three-dimensional system. So this 1 over E seems to be a very robust result independent of the type of thermostat and things that we apply. However, it's very different from what's been reported on models with the same kind of potential, but with different dynamics. So these are simulations that were done with energy minimization as opposed to inertial dynamics. And here you have the probability of events of a given energy, and this is the energy. But now instead of a log-log scale, it's log-linear. And so you have a very nice exponential relation as opposed to power law. Now, this is very surprising to me and to people who've worked on other avalanche systems of the kind that Karen talked about last week, where in most cases, if you add inertia, it gets rid of the power law. So if you take systems with quench disorder and you add inertia, it typically drives you away from criticality. And yet here, without inertia, you see an exponential, but with inertia, you see a power law. There's other models where inertia without disorder gives you a range of power law scaling, although it's not perfectly power law, there tends to be a bump at very large system, very large event sizes in these systems. So this is unusual, just to show you that inertia matters in other ways. This is the potential energy and the shear stress of systems that are solved by energy minimization versus this Galilean invariant damping. And you can see that the potential energy is consistently lower. Energy minimization gives you a higher energy, counterintuitively perhaps, and also a higher stress. And this is a systematic trend. And if you look at the spikiness, the serration here, I think you'll see that there's more large events in the Kelvin damping than in the energy minimization. You can sort of see that by your naked eye, okay? So what's going on, of course, is that energy minimization takes you to the closest minimum, but inertia lets you move beyond. And I think you really expect this to be a more realistic description of dynamics in compressed solids that are being crushed or in the earthquakes at large enough length scales. And it changes the dynamics of the events and the size distribution of the events. To show you again that this is a real effect, what I've done is taken a non-Galilean invariant thermostat, something that takes the velocity relative to some inertial frame to zero, a so-called Langevin thermostat. And these are with different damping rates and different system sizes. And what you see is that in all cases, you get something sort of flat at low energies, and then something that's dropping much more rapidly than linearly on this log-log scale. This is a more or less exponential decay, just like in the energy minimization dynamics, but now using overdamped Langevin dynamics. Very different from this, which has many more events at small length scales or energy scales and also at large energy scales. So what we think is going on, inertia sort of lets you run away, lets you have very big effects, which can dissipate a lot of energy, maybe get things very hot and melt things. And it also creates a lot of disorder around the event. And that disorder seems to increase the amount of small events which can occur later on. So it acts on both ends of the spectrum. Okay. Now, we can go ahead and we can look at the duration of these events as a function of energy. And for the large events, it seems roughly like the time scales like the square root of the energy. If you think of these as occupying an area and there being some sort of sound propagation, then the time for things to propagate would go like the square root of the energy, because that would be like the radius of a compact object in two dimensions. You can also look at things like the stress drops, and you find that the stress drop is proportional to the energy for the large events. But I want to be careful to point out that this is the stress drop that we determine using the same definition for when the event is over that we use to determine the energy. If instead you look at the stress curve and you look at the distribution of distances between maximum and minimum, you will find many more events. You will take things we lump because they're causally connected and split them up. And so this can actually give you a different power law if that distribution than the one we found for the energy and the stress using the causally connected definition. And many times in experiments, I think this is what's analyzed, which may be why different power laws are obtained. For example, if we think about how an earthquake would be analyzed, this shows some event with the energy dropping over a long time. The kinetic energy shows a bunch of spikes. Each one of those spikes would be detected by a seismometer as a separate earthquake and split up into a different event. And if we split things up in the same way, we get a very different result. This is now not the probability, but the integrated probability, okay? So all events bigger than some size, and we now get something with a power law for this going like minus 0.4, so the probability itself would go like minus 1.4, very different than before. And, you know, Gutenberg-Richter gives you something for this integrated probability that's closer to that number. So I think this is a natural way to break up events, but not necessarily what's been done before. It also turns out that the size spatially of events correlates with the energy. If you look at the number of regions, and I'll describe in a minute how we do that, that have gone through a given size deformation, In one of these events, there's a more or less linear relation between the regions of large perturbation and the energy of the event. So how do we, what am I plotting there? We want some measure of the local shear, because we think of things as atoms sliding past each other. And we divide space in our two-dimensional system into triangles connecting the atoms of the system. And then we can get all the derivatives of the displacement field in that triangle from the displacements of the corners. There's only four derivatives of the displacement field that we need. We have three corners, we have two displacements of each, and there's a center of mass that cancels out. So we have just enough degrees of freedom to uniquely specify derivatives of the displacement field on these triangles. And then we focus on something you normally throw away in elastic theory, which is the curl of the displacement field, which measures the rotation. So this is measuring whether atoms are shearing this way, which would be a clockwise or right strain rotation, or the opposite way, which would be a left strain. And this is very useful because we're going to see that there's even, I showed you large avalanches, but it turns out these avalanches are themselves correlated over longer times, and there's multiple avalanches that tend to occur in regions of correlated space. So here are some of these individual earthquakes with energies of order 100, 24, 2, and 1. And these things actually happened in sequence. And so this is where there was a very big event. And this one turns out to have been in a very nearby region. Yeah? These are the total change over one of the events as I've defined them before. Okay, and I'm just showing you a few snapshots. I got a movie which I've been at about 10 o'clock this morning, which I've been unable to put in. Maybe I can show it at the end.
But so this isn't a snapshot of the instantaneous configuration,
the instant,
some kind of time.
It's the curl of the displacement field measured from the start of an event to the end of an event. And so you see things that are very small, and you see things that are very, very big. And they have a large complex spatial structure. The black and white represent things that are rotating or shearing in different senses, and they tend to correlate along these 45 degree axes of the, which are the easiest shear directions. Okay, and so if we look over a larger strain interval containing many events, we find that there tends to be some correlation between successive avalanches, where they occur, and what their sense is in terms of this strain, and that's what I want to talk about next. So oftentimes people look at the total displacement, the non-affine displacement field in a system. That's what's shown here. And there's a problem if we think about some plastic band, I won't call it a shear band just to be safe, where we have some displacement, some change in the shear over some length scale. Because when we look at the affine component, we're subtracting the mean strain, we get something like this. And so the magnitude is maximum on either side of our band and zero in the center. Okay, so it's not a very good way of looking at things. If instead we look at the curl of the displacement field for the same interval of strain, this is now a very big system, a very small strain interval, you see that there's this band has a lot of structure within it, and that there's black correlated this way and white correlated that way. Okay, now this, if you now look at the next interval and increase the range of strain to 0.2%, you find that there tends to be a correlation where there's more activity in the region that you already saw things. Okay? So each one of these snapshots is not one avalanche. This would be maybe 30 or 40 avalanches that would contribute to this net displacement field. And they've been correlated. They're not randomly arranged. And they've led at the end of the correlation to a net displacement over this plastic region of about an atomic diameter. It seems like you sort of have to move things by about that distance, which makes sense, to really sample a new state. And until an entire correlated region has moved by that far, you tend to get more activity in that same region. It's somewhat related to the things Chris was talking about, where the motion in different regions has to be coupled. Once you've done that, then you can get activity in new regions, and it tends to actually go somewhere else. And the scale of these features does seem to scale like system size, which is something else that was mentioned earlier. Okay. Given the time, I'm going to skip that. Now, I just want to show you, if you look at the distribution of the vorticity that's produced by these events, there's a lot of space that has very small vorticity. This is the elastically deformed region. And then there's a tail that's exponential with a characteristic decay of 0.1. This corresponds to a strain of, because there's a half in strain, but not in the curl, a strain of about 5%. So there's something more than 5%, you're seeing plasticity. And as you increase the total strain you look at, you just see more and more of the system has undergone this plastic deformation. So if we want to characterize the correlations of this curl, we can take the structure factor, just take the Fourier transform and square it. And if we look at how that depends upon the wave vector, averaging the logarithm of S for reasons I'll explain in a moment, you see a very nice power law behavior. And as long as you look at strain intervals bigger than about 1 over the system size, it turns out that all that changes as you increase the strain interval that you look at is the prefactor. You can take the numerical derivative and you see that these have the same slope within our accuracy. Okay? So basically we see a nice power law behavior, and the fact that these rise linearly with the strain rate means that above this scale they're adding incoherently. Okay? But for scales up to about 1 over L, they are correlated, and we get some power law. And it's a very anisotropic power law. So what I'm doing here is, rather than averaging over directions, looking along specific directions in wave vector, and you can see that, say, at 45 degrees along this line, you get a much higher power law than along these directions, okay? And again, we've taken a numerical derivative of these curves. And what I want to specifically point out is, if you look at this direction and this direction, or this direction and this direction, the results for the derivative completely collapse. Only the prefactor is different between these, okay? So it's a very unusual critical behavior with an exponent that depends apparently continuously on orientation, a prefactor that also depends on direction, and they have different sort of periodicities. The prefactor is different for this and this, but the exponent is the same, okay? Now, in fact, you can sort of rationalize the difference in the prefactors using Moore Coulomb, which says that the planes with the smallest normal stress are going to be easiest to shear along. So something like this, because it's at more of an angle to the compressive axis, has less normal pressure than this, and that's why you get the larger prefactor. And in fact, you see something at small scales that looks more like Moore Coulomb in the sense of having some this direction being favored. But at large length scales, you're dominated by these special 45 degree axes. Okay, and so this is sort of consistent with the anisotropy that's evident to your eye in these patterns. So just to conclude, If you look at this very specific limit of quasi-static temperature equals zero dynamics, you find a very robust power law which doesn't seem to depend upon dimension or many of the other aspects of the dynamics, the potential, etc. It's over a wide range, and it's very sensitive to the inertia, the fact that you let systems continue to move forward through the energy landscape to subsequent minima carried by the momenta of the particles. These events tend to localize for some period of time containing many avalanches into coherent bands until you accumulate a net slip of order a particle diameter. The thickness of these regions seems to be controlled by system size, although within them there's much sharper features that go down to the scale of individual atoms. And it turns out that if you look now at the non-affine displacement of these systems, these results actually imply that the diffusion constant you would measure from the non-affine displacement scales linearly with system size, which in fact is found over about two orders of magnitude in L in these simulations. Over short intervals, over the time it takes for this sort of correlation to build up, you get power law correlations with a rather unusual anisotropic exponent and prefactor. And so, this is all at zero temperature. We could have in the discussion talk about what may happen at finite temperature, but these are very long-range correlations where things moving here really have to make something else move. And I think that some feature of this may remain even at higher temperatures in other systems, and I'll close there. So I see the chairman standing up.
We have time for some discussion.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the scalings of avalanche sizes. And first, I'd like to make a precision that there are two exponents, one which is the power law of the distribution of small events, and the other one which is the cutoff. And they are not necessarily related. The 1.4 here corresponds to the cutoff. And the exponents you've been focusing on is the distribution at low event sizes. And I think that in 3D, I don't
know. There's a qualitative difference, complete qualitative difference between these results and mine. I think what you may be saying is that you can interpret some of the data as having a power law at low energy scales followed by an exponential decay.
Like your pink curve, for example.
Well, my pink curve is, yeah. This is a cutoff that's associated with a number of digits that I'm printing out, nothing else.
I'm talking about the slope. You have a slope, okay, roughly minus one, that's the one you were talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, so that we agree. I think we have always agreed on that. And the next question is, what is the cutoff at the highest event sizes?
And okay.
That's governed by two different exponents.
Well,
The exponents minus one you find is for the slope here, the rough slope of the distribution.
Yeah.
And the exponent 1.4 you discuss is not that. The exponent 1.4 corresponds to the cutoff of the large events.
I hear you, but you're not, there is a big difference between these results and what I just showed you. These results do not have a significant number of events in the power law regime. If you blow up the scale of these curves, in some cases, in the very small limit, there is an initial power law. In your early data in this paper, it was not independent of system size. And because the power law is very small, the total integrated number of events in that limit is negligible, right?
I agree, yes. We had small, yes. That's just the issue, yes, right.
No, it has not, no.
Small samples, for sure.
No, it's the dynamics. That's my whole point, is that this has almost no events. The integrated number of events in these simulations, in both of these, at the small length scales before the exponential cutoff is basically zero. In this sort of distribution, yes, you can say there's an exponential cutoff here. All the events are in the power law, and that's a completely different physical distribution.
Well, all these distribution, if you have a power law distribution, it means that the large events are rare. I mean, the conclusion we had, for example, a scaling with L of the large avalanche in 2D was exactly the same. So what's...
No, it's not. No, it's not.
No, it is. That's what we wrote.
Okay. I've had this discussion with Craig as well, and I think that he agrees with this point. But look, you're saying the largest event scales with system size, but that largest event is in the power law tail, right?
Yes.
And the exponential cutoff of the power law starts at an energy scale that's always very small. It's very analogous to this, where I get the power law, such as it exists, if it exists, okay, is only at energies below 0.1, independent of system size.
Do you still conclude that there are avalanches which are scaling with the power of L, which is roughly 1 in 2D? Yes or no?
I'm not. The point, yes, there are some big events.
We agree. Okay.
No, but I think it's a fundamentally different thing to say that you have an exponential cutoff above an energy of 0.1, where that exponential decay is determined by the largest event, okay, L to the power 1, and saying that you get a power law all the way out to the largest events in the system, where that power law grows with the system size. So I think that these are very different distributions, and yes, the biggest events that you can get will grow with system size, but you're exponentially unlikely to see it in one case.
That's for sure, yes. That's a property of all power laws.
What?
We'll need to discuss offline, because I don't see really well.
So you think these are the same?
Mark, I was, like a lot of people, I was probably very intrigued by your structure factor for this angle of rotation, or the curl of the displacement field. And I wondered whether the constants A and B in this expression for alpha were universal. Did you look at how they depended on, how, if at all, they changed, if you changed the interactions, or?
No.
So are these results just for one particular potential?
The only ones, we've only gone to the large system sizes needed to be able to resolve because of the discrete resolution of angle. We've only gone to the really big system sizes for one particular system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I think the qualitatively everything looks the same in terms of the patterns, but how universal these exponents are, we don't know at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mark, have you looked at what happens if you increase shear rate? Because you're saying in the quasi-static limit, with the underdamped dynamics, it's really different from energy minimization and so forth. How much of a difference is there, for example, between underdamped and overdamped avalanche sizes at higher shear rates?
Well, so one of the problems one has if one goes to higher shear rates is how you decide what an event is, right?
Yeah.
And the way that we've defined things is really hard to generalize to that limit. You get arbitrary thresholds and other things when things have stopped, okay?
Of people have looked at statistics of energy drops and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but what I've said is that an energy drop, right, what is an energy drop? I mean, I can define many energy drops within this, right, and I will get different statistics. I think it's natural to say, are they causally connected? That's clean in this limit. It's very hard at finite rate. What I can say is if we begin to go to higher rates, we do see that some of these begin to overlap. Initially, that overlap is a relatively trivial space, you know, things in different spatial regions can overlap in time, right? And that doesn't really change the scaling. As you go to really higher rates, then before one of these can start, another one will trigger. One of my concerns about that crossover regime is that it may depend upon things related to what we were talking about with Jean-Louis the other day in terms of whether you're using slot dynamics or driving from a boundary. Because the way that strain is transmitted is very different in those cases, and the temporal coupling of the strain rate can be different. You know, one case you're by hand forcing strain to go everywhere, and so you can trigger something in a region just because you're forcing it, whereas in another you're driving from a boundary, and so I think it'll be interesting to see whether that the overlap regime is affected by that driving criteria.
So you were arguing that the inertia effects play a role. How do you, in the sense on how it affects the thermostat thing? I mean, that you can overcome a smaller barrier because you have a lot of momentum, basically. So would you expect that you have the similar depends of the, on the thermostat if you would have a different type of glass form? I mean, a strong glass form where perhaps the local barriers are higher, so that basically even if you have a little bit more energy, that you would be stopped in the first minimum, and therefore there is, wouldn't be an issue on the thermostat. Would you expect this to be the case? Because all the systems that you looked at are some sort of Hartz-Fierisch, Leonard-Jones-ish.
We looked at Leonard-Jones and harmonic, and we've looked at different pressures, which is one way that you can try to increase the energy barriers.
There you change it a little. It's not a very strong change. I mean, yeah. If you would do it for silica or something like this.
Silica, yeah, that might be a challenge for us. But no, I that's an interesting question. But I would still think that we, you know, if you look at the Earth, right, we get these runaway earthquake events, and they're clearly inertial. They're clearly not, you know, overdamped motion. So it may just be an issue of length scale.
Mark, this morning you heard about these results from Nick's group and several others now about these pillars, the formation of the metallic glass pillars, and obviously they have a size or length scale effect here in their results. At least they are controversial, I know, and many different people see different effects. Could you somehow rationalize that here, as you have the length scale of your system is reducing, the number of energy displaced in one avalanche is actually smaller, so you actually see this what they describe as homogeneous flow as a huge number of small events with small energy releases?
I don't know. I mean, I think anything I would say would be speculative. But I think there's another potential size effect in that would be unrelated to this potentially. But you know, I talked about there being this need for things to accumulate up to some sort of strain level, right? You could imagine that at big enough length scales, you could sort of terminate things in the same sense that you can pin a dislocation in a big enough sample, or you can have a crack pin in a big enough. You can pin a dislocation. So if you look at friction, it turns out that there's a similar scale dependence, which is related to whether part of the interface can move coherently. Incoherently from the rest. Mm-hmm. And that's related to the cost of putting in some sort of boundary, like a crack or a dislocation where part has moved and part hasn't. And there's a cost for that boundary, that edge. Yeah. And so if there's a length scale where basically you can have such an edge, right, a minimum core size or something, right, then you get a length scale. And there could be at some larger length scale than this something analogous where you can end one of these events. That's hand waving.
Yeah, just a quick clarification. I think you said this, but I'm not sure. In your power law, where you have the power law distribution, does the low end of that distribution also grow with system size, the small event? So as you go to large, you said the high cutoff goes grows with system size. Is that true for the low end also?
So you want to know what's happening down here?
Yeah.
For this
if basically
so this little bump here is in fact associated with numerical roundoff error. Because I have a big system, I'm trying to get small numbers on top of a very big number. And that's what's shifting this out. I have no reason to think that the smallest events are disappearing. On the other hand, I'm a little surprised that this power law goes down to such large energies. And some of what we've seen would suggest that really energies below some point really are not part of the critical scaling completely.
Uh-huh. And then one other quick point was when you have your pattern for the slip for a single avalanche, can you tell in which direction it propagated from the structure? Is that sort of?
Oh, you mean where it started from that?
Yeah.
No, I guess one of the things I didn't say is we've looked at, say, the modes of the Hessian that are going soft just before the events, which is one way people identify saddle points or instabilities. And you do find a correlation between those soft modes and where the failure begins. But it's not possible to predict what will result based on the eigenvalues of those initial modes. You tend to get things propagating and you can get very big events that are not obvious from that initial mode. I don't think I could tell you from looking at these which started, but you can see clearly they can be spatially disconnected regions that are causally connected.
Can you talk about the dependence on the type of disorder? For example, how would exponents change as you change the disorder? Or what is sort of the minimum ingredient in the disorder that's needed for all this phenomenology to happen?
Well, from what we can tell, it seems to be very robust. I mean, I can't comment on things like, you know, silica glasses and real directional bonding. These are all non-directionally bonded. But other than that, the macroscopic straining method and the potential don't seem to matter too much. The key thing seems to be that it's under damped inertia. And I should also say that if I can put up the Kelvin damping, I can overdamp short wavelengths, which might be something that would be relevant, again, for glasses at high temperatures. You might think, say, low, small scales are overdamped. That doesn't change this. It changes the small events. So that's another thing that we've looked at.
I mean, how do you characterize disorder in the systems? This distribution and what quantities do you think are crucial?
I don't really know how to answer that. I think the one thing we are doing is if you look, say, down here in the initial state, the types of disorder may be very dependent upon how we made the system. But by going into this regime, somehow the type of disorder that we've generated has tuned to whatever a rejuvenated system, whatever a flowing system would be. And in this regime, we seem to see this behavior. In this regime, there's some maximum event size that's much smaller, and it's a different story. So there's some disorder up here that we haven't tried to calculate in terms of, you know, local spring constants or anything, but.
Thanks.
Okay, I think we're going to have to move on. Let's thank Mark again.